Hey, podcast listeners. Hello, and welcome to Words the Podcast, the show where we talk about words and the people who wrote them. Today's episode features journalist Dave Askins, formerly of the Ann Arbor Chronicle, and who's currently working on a new civic engagement project called Civ City. Jeff Garland, a short story writer who wrote Shut a Duck Confit, a story about an unfortunate caterer working at the Michigan Union, and Brenda McCaffrey, a poet who writes about life in college. This is an hour-long podcast, so please feel free to take a moment, hit pause, and press the download button on our SoundCloud page to listen to this podcast at your leisure. And if you'd like to read the full text of either Jeff's short story or Brendan's poetry, please visit our website at www.wordsthepodcast.com, where we've made both texts available for you to read. I'm so glad that you're tuning in today, and please remember to tune in each and every Sunday when we'll be releasing a new episode of Words the Podcast from now until May. But now, on this January 25th, without further ado, the very first episode of Words the Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Words, the podcast where we talk about words and the people who write them. Today we are joined, as always, by Yassine Abdul-Mekhi, Jack Bologna, and I'm Phil Wittevine. And our guest today is Dave Askins, who is a journalist, writer, and owns and operates a nonprofit organization in Ann Arbor.
Just a general man about town. That's
the, Yes, I think that owns and operates a nonprofit here in Ann Arbor is maybe overstating the case, given that the nonprofit was just incorporated late last year.
Civ City, yeah.
Yes, the Civ City Initiative is the name of the nonprofit. It is incorporated as a nonprofit, but it has not yet achieved its 501c3 status.
See, okay. But before we get into Civ City, which is fascinating, talk a little about yourself.
The Ann Arbor Chronicle was, from my perspective, not something that I set out to do because I had some idea that I wanted to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. I wanted actually to help make Mary Morgan's enterprise succeed. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, I'm sort of an accidental journalist. For our audience, there was a fondness and affection for the publication that I really do appreciate, and I never anticipated that we would be able to cultivate. I think it's worth remembering, though, that our audience was fairly limited. Mm-hmm. So it was a specialized publication for a specialized audience. And actually, I'll just plug the new nonprofit, the Civ City Initiative, a little bit here. Whereas our mission with the Chronicle was never to try to grow that audience. We just wanted to serve that existing audience.
Yeah.
The mission of the Civ City Initiative is to try to expand that market, mm-hmm. to try to increase the number of people who might care at all what the Ann Arbor City Council did the previous evening.
Yeah.
And our goal is to somehow find a way to weave civic life into all aspects of community life here in Ann Arbor City.
Do you think that, like, what you're doing with Civ City or the Ann Arbor Chronicle, like, do you think it could exist in other cities, or is Ann Arbor a special place to that? And how do you think, like, what you've done? Because, I mean, you know, you guys got written up in, you know, the Harvard Nieman Journalism Lab, which is a very, I think, a large deal. I think people were taking note of what the Ann Arbor Chronicle was doing. I bet there's people in a lot of other cities that were wondering, can we do something similar? And guys, feel free to chime in, like, regarding, like, local journalism, like what do people look for? Is this something that could happen in a city not like Ann Arbor?
I don't know. That's my answer to that question.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the hurdles or one of the challenges that exists here in Ann Arbor is the same challenge that exists anywhere, which is that it's human beings who make up the population of all these cities. And human beings crave good stories. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in the sense of narrative stories, you know, pieces of writing that have a plot trajectory, that have interesting characters, who say interesting things, who have critical conflicts with each other. These are all the basic elements of good stories, and we as human beings, we love that sort of thing. And that's exactly not the sort of thing that that the Ann Arbor Chronicle was in the business of providing. We were in the business of providing reports. Mm. So our model was not the narrative paradigm. Our model was a scientific report or a scientific paper. So I think that one of the challenges then is, you know, most human beings, we are hardwired. What do we like better? What's more interesting and fun? A story. Tell me a story. Mm-hmm. Not give me a scientific report I can read.
Yeah. But you guys did make it work in the city, or well, you know.
Well, we made it work for 6 years.
Like what you were saying about general population being interested in like narratives and stories. It kind of reminds me of like Vice News. You guys know about Vice News?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was just looking at something the other day where there was like a riot in Sao Paulo, and like that's something that's like really interesting because it's just like really grainy bad video footage of something that's actually happening, but it's like a slice of something that's actually happening somewhere in the world that somebody took the time to put on like Twitter or social media that everybody can like take a piece of and say this is something that's actually going on, akin to like what happened in Ferguson, because I was actually in Rio de Janeiro when it happened, and I learned about it through Twitter, not through like the news or anything like that. And
it's kind of like getting people to connect with those things through a variety of different ways.
Yeah, and I feel like the Assist City initiative is like really is like a really good way to get people to think of like scientific reports or like news reports, things that happen, finding a way to put your own color on it, to say this is what happens and this is how I feel about what happened without actually having to say that.
Yeah. My recollection from following Ferguson was that Vice News had people on the ground with they were broadcasting live through some technology that was not necessarily super reliable, but you could sort of get a sense of the chaos and mayhem. But to me, that's less conventional storytelling, and that's more sort of giving you a voyeuristic sort of peek into, okay, that's actually happening. There's somebody who's actually there, and that's exciting. There's a sort of visceral sense to...
And an immediacy almost, which, I mean, yeah. I think, and when you mentioned Twitter, too, I mean, like, that's... I mean, I think people sometimes, I think it's just, you know, people posting dumb things about, like, whatever's on their mind, but it's also, I mean, it is this weird journalism tool where anyone who's not necessarily a journalist can be talking about what's happening around them. And suddenly, like, one of, like, the most powerful ways to kind of learn about an issue that's happening, like, you know, what was happening in Brazil or like, Ferguson, is to go on your Twitter stream and see this huge collection of, you know, journalists or a columnist or just everyday people. And in a sense, like, the Civ City Initiative, like, that kind of, like, does bring in, you know, everybody that's trying to, you know, get everyone involved.
Yeah, so any person could be the person who's live on the ground reporting. And I think that, I mean, why do we trust the account of somebody who's reporting through a Vice News stream? It's because they're there. Mm-hmm. They're actually physically there. And actually that was, you know, the Chronicle's tagline was, it's like being there. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was the key element that that helped folks trust that what we were reporting was not somebody's secondhand account of what happened at the meeting, but it was based on somebody who was actually an eyewitness to the event. Right, so imagine it this way. You have an online encyclopedia, ArborWiki. Your dedicated journalists and citizen contributors work at the task of updating that thing on a super timely basis. So just-in-time archiving. So city council acts, you slot in the new and relevant information. we will then develop a piece of software to layer on top of that that would help us monitor all the changes and additions to the archive. And out of those updates, you build the news feed.
Wow.
So it kind of turns the concept of archiving on its head.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, if you're talking about, like, if a library were to say we want to have an archive of news stories, you rely on privately published stuff. I mean, privately in the sense of privately owned.
Yeah,
so,
like old newspapers, stacks of newspapers.
Right, and we will preserve those stacks of newspapers in nice, neat piles.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're digital piles. But in any case, the flow of work is we gather up stuff that somebody else has published and we store it in the archive. This way, or this approach would say, let's take the archive, let's update it, and then out of the archive we build the news feed. So if someone says, all right, this news feed, gosh, I hope somebody's saving all this information, our answer to that is, it's already been saved. So this came from the saved archived, stored material. And, you know, you might get a very short news item about what happened, but there would be a link back to the encyclopedia. So for, you know, somebody who wanted to understand the entire background of that topic, you know, your prototypical Chronicle reader, they could click through and get that entire background.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say this is almost like a if everything works to the plan, it'll kind of be like a self-sustaining and perhaps even more in-depth version of the Ann Arbor Chronicle in some ways?
Yes, I mean, sure. Let me market it this way. It'll be like the Ann Arbor Chronicle, but even better.
Oh, wow.
But back to your point about the Vice News and being able to follow something on the ground, I think that part of what we want to achieve with the CivCity initiative is to be able to engage people in the community to actually go out to the physical places where civics is happening or where news is happening and to brush up against our civic life in that way. So for the mayoral primary in August, we partnered with the Ann Arbor District Library, which runs a summer reading program called the Summer Game.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you may be familiar with summer reading programs.
You read a bunch of pages and then you get like pizza or something.
Yeah, something along those lines.
I thought it was something akin to like the Summer Games, like the Hunger Games. You read these books and then it's like a knockout round.
Kids in a library.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any violence associated with it, but. But
it's still interesting. You know, it's
I'm convinced you're familiar with the concept. You've got the idea. So, so participants in the summer game, they could read books or do other things that the library had devised for them to do, like go visit a museum, and then in one of the exhibits, there's a game code that you write down, and then you log the game code and you get points, that sort of thing. And so, just a couple of days before the elections happened, I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great to have an army of people to fan out across the city to visit the precincts when they close down the polls at 8 o'clock in the evening so that we could get early polling results. We had done that sort of thing in the past, sort of in informally through the Chronicle's network of folks, but just
for our listeners, I mean, because in the past, typically what would be happening is you'd have people that are actually running for office and like their campaign teams doing this kind of reporting, or like, you know, newspapers or whatnot.
Less so newspapers.
Because they just rely on these candidates. Yeah.
Right. The typical strategy, I think, that sort of the corporate media presence in town would take is to simply tag along to the victory.
The watch parties.
To the watch parties of the well-organized campaigns. And those well-organized campaigns would have volunteers reporting in the stuff rather than having people on the ground reporting directly to them. And so it was just a matter of days before the election that I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great if the summer game participants could be incentivized to do that and they would get summer game points. And so I tweeted at the deputy director for the Ann Arbor District Library, Eli Nyberger, who runs the summer game. And much to my surprise, instead of saying, that's way too late, we can't, you know, do something on that short of notice. He said, yeah, we actually designed the software and everything to be flexible, and yet I think we can probably do that. And by Sunday, I think I tweeted at him on a Friday, and by Sunday he had the whole thing set up for the Tuesday election. And we ended up having, it was around 14 or 15 families with kids go to the polls to get these early results. And, you know, they texted them or emailed them to me, and then I would email them the game code, and they would go off and cash in their, you know, their points for the summer game. Okay. So two things. One, it was a great journalistic scoop. I mean, we had the early results by, I think, probably 8:30. Probably 60 or 70% of the precincts that reported in, it was clear that Christopher Taylor indeed was going to win the race. But more valuable to me was the fact that there were at least some families and kids who were going out to shut down the polls, who probably had no idea that you could even do that. And they brushed up against that piece of our civic life in a way that, you know, I'm really rooting for.
Yeah, and like, so not only are they like reading about civic news, but they're actually engaging and participating.
Right, and they are the people on the ground.
Yeah. They're the vice news reporters.
Exactly. And, so I am really rooting for some kid in some family around about next, you know, August, saying, oh, that thing we did last year, do we get to do that again this year? And I hope the answer is, well, yes, of course.
So I guess that's a great way to go into the next question. So between now and a more actualized Civ City, what are the magic bullet points on the way to, like, what are you thinking of in terms of what you're going to actually do?
I would say that probably the first tangible evidence of the fact that we're actually working will be some form of the news and information service that I sketched out, you know, built on top of ArborWiki. The Ann Arbor District Library, I believe, will be a valuable supporting partner in that. And to me personally, that's the piece of it that I'm most interested in putting my time and effort into. There's but in terms of like timeline, really the first step is to assess what the result of the fundraising effort was. Okay. So we sent out a fundraising letter in mid to late December. And the nonprofit that is acting as our fiscal sponsor, which is called A2 Geeks, they are handling the influx of all those donations. And by fiscal sponsor, I mean the entity that is allowing or that is accepting donations so that folks who contribute can actually get a tax deduction because they have 501c3 status.
And people,
ours is only pending.
Okay,
but but people can still go to www.civcity.org
and that information is there
and still donate and whatnot. And that's still
the information for how to donate is there. But the donations, I mean, the checks at this point still need to be written to A2D. So really, the touchstone number one as a bullet point is to find out what the result of that fundraising effort was.
Okay.
And is. It's ongoing.
Would you think of Civ City as like a community or more of like a platform for a community? Or I guess that could be like answered in many different ways. I guess there's a lot of different ways. I mean, it seems like ultimately what you're trying to get to is, you know, the civic life brushing up against people's actual lived experience and just like this...
Well, I would say that it's neither a community nor a platform to build a new community. I would say that it's an enterprise that needs, I think, to be successful, to be aware of existing communities and to understand what the relationships are between those various existing communities and not to try to co-opt those communities to a different purpose, but to just acknowledge that they exist and that that is a those are sort of the building pieces of what life is in Ann Arbor. So I think that when people set out to build a community, I would say, okay, that's a fool's errand. You know, communities are going to evolve in whatever organic way, and once they exist, it's worth noticing, ah, yes, there's that community. Now, if I want to share my message, or if I want to if I want to share my message with that community, or get some information in front of that community, or get that community to, or get the members of that community to do something, then I need to reflect on how that might best be done. But the idea that I'm going to create a new community, I think is, God knows what might happen if you did such a thing, but I'm less interested in trying to create brand new things out of whole cloth, and I'm much more interested in saying, okay, what exists now? How can we inject sort of civic activities into what those communities' life
already? Like the reader games or the summer games.
Right,
like,
so instead of saying, we need a civic game here, I think, you know, and to start... you know, manufacturing that from scratch, I mean, the most natural way to do that would be to work with the Ann Arbor District Library so that maybe they start a thing called the Civic Game, but they would use the same software platform and they would, you know, introduce it via their usual summer game clientele.
Is this like a hint right now to any public employees of the library?
Well, I mean, we're in productive conversations already with the Ann Arbor District Library on this topic. So okay. I'm not trying to send them a secret message there. We have talked to them directly on this.
I mean, but Dave, I do want to let you know that you are going to get the Words the Podcast bump from coming out and talking about this. So,
well,
you know,
I'm sure.
Things suddenly move a lot faster.
Okay.
You know.
But, so, you know, in the spirit of the idea that there's not going to be a magic bullet, you know, what we talked about just before we started recording, this, you know, the Murray Avenue Times.
Can you explain, like, what that is? Because I think that's really cool.
I haven't counted the pages. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Dave is a prop.
7, 8, 9, 10. This is a 10-page... publication, the Murray Avenue Times. It's published by Lucy Tobier and Linnea Verhey-Henke. Those are two, I believe they're 10 and 11 years old. They live the next block over from me on Murray Avenue. And this edition, I think it's the November edition of the Murray Avenue Times, showed up in my mailbox. But I mean, among the things that I think would actually be of historical interest, mm-hmm. They have an article here where they sort of list out the Halloween costumes that neighborhood kids wore this year. Hmm. And I think through Halloween costumes, you get a sense of like maybe what the state of American popular culture was. So 50 years from now, I actually think it will be interesting to folks who are studying the history of the United States. You know, Max was a bumblebee from the Transformers. Liam was Jed from Star Wars. Now, Jed, I mean, I'm not an expert on the Star Wars, you know, franchise, but I'm not sure who's... Henry was a raccoon. And then there's this editorial comment that is just great. Close your garbage lids. So, Angel was the Brazilian soccer player Pele.
Pele's a legend.
So, would you call this something that you're envisioning for a person doing civics without thinking about it? The editorial note, close your garbage.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. There's a trivia quiz.
Wait, what are some of the questions for the trivia quiz, actually? Are there any good ones? Or are they like very specific to Murray Avenue?
No, these are actually very general questions. That was a suggestion that I sent along after receiving this, and this is the way I imagine this CivCity initiative to be working. My suggestion was, you know, these are fun questions, and people can test their knowledge. I mean, who wrote To Kill the Mockingbird? You three?
Wait, Harper Johnson.
Harper, no, it's like Lisa.
Truman Capote.
Truman
Harper.
Jack, you nailed it. Harper Lee. Who was the 13th president?
Oh, golly. It's not Jackson.
Lincoln? No, he's 16, right? No.
Yeah, he is the 16th.
16, so if we work backwards chronologically.
All right.
Because you have them memorized, of course.
Like McKinley.
I used to.
McKinley's was after. Jackson?
Was it a Whig president? Was it like John Tyler?
I'll just tell you, Millard Fillmore.
What the heck? Damn.
Who was Millard Fillmore?
He's the guy with the sideburns.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah.
That was...
Question three. Who invented potato chips?
Derek Lays.
George Crumb.
George Crumb.
These are hard. How do these girls...
Is that where the word crumbs comes from?
I'm thinking not.
That would be cool.
There's no B on the... it's just C-R-U-M. But, so, I mean, trivia, general trivia is fun, as we have just proven. but, so, you know, I want to sort of get the tentacles of the Civ City Initiative into this publication by encouraging them to have civic-based trivia. So things like how many oak trees are in the city of Ann Arbor. Because you can look that stuff up on the city website. You can find that out.
How would you envision, I guess, like, you know, these two girls and their publication, like, working within Civ City? I mean, or is that, you know...
Well, see, I guess I don't see them working within Civ City so much as Civ City being aware that they exist, making what I would consider to be a useful and positive suggestion that to these general trivia questions, they could add specific civics questions.
Mm-hmm.
So my real goal there is, and maybe this lets the cat out of the bag, but for these two girls to come up with civic trivia questions, they're going to have to learn something about civic topics. So my real educational audience is not sort of the community via the Murray Avenue Times.
Mm-hmm.
It is the people who are making the Murray Avenue Times. They will brush up against civic content in a way they would not otherwise if they didn't have to make a civic quiz for every issue.
Mm.
So it seems like Civ City is something that you're negotiating between parties that already exist, and so maybe Civ City is something that can exist on like Flickr or Pinterest or, you know, on Twitter,
multiple platforms. Yeah.
Storify.com, that seems even more within what we've been talking about. And so I guess my question is, if you feel like the what is it called,
The Murray Avenue Times.
Which is...
That's blowing up on this podcast today. We're just...
No, it's true. We should... You know what? We should start a, like... We should just announce hashtags so that our listeners can get things straight.
Oh, so they can, like, live tweet when they listen.
Yeah. So for our live tweet... For all the people listening live, of course, there are none. But... hashtag Murray Street Times.
Or Murray Avenue.
Murray Avenue Times. Hashtag Murray Avenue Times. Okay.
And then we can collect those tweets... The three that maybe you could tweet, and then
That's,
well, there will be at least three because there's three of us.
Oh yeah,
I'll tweet Murray Avenue Times. Obviously.
Well, right. So I mean, when you described the sort of the landscape of different sort of social media things, Tumblr and Pinterest and all that, the rest of that, I imagine that the Civ City Initiative would have some sort of presence on all those things you just named, but. I wouldn't want to define Civ City as, what is Civ City? It's a Facebook page, or it's a website, or it's this thing. It's rather, it's a nonprofit.
I'm sitting down with Jeff Garland. Who is going to read his story, Shredded Duck Confit, which is an hors d'oeuvre, not an appetizer, an hors d'oeuvre. Could you explain real quick what that is?
A shredded duck confit.
Yeah.
It's an appetizer or an hors d'oeuvre, I guess.
Okay.
And I think it's, I describe it pretty well in the story, but. It can be anything. The story, this the example of the story is pretty specific, but basically it's duck cooked in its own fat.
Yeah,
is what the confit is.
And if you could just give the listeners out there a little bit of a roadmap of what this story is about.
I suppose it's about a lot of things. But literally, it's a caterer who works at the union, and he's been tasked with hand passing, which anyone who's catered probably loathes. It's a miserable task. But so he's been tasked to do it, and he goes around and he can't give away any of his hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah.
And that kind of troubles him.
Everyone hates the confit.
Yeah, well...
He doesn't call it a confit at first.
He doesn't know what it is. That's kind of the trick. He doesn't know the name of the... what he thinks is an appetizer, what is technically an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah.
And that kind of... That disconnect in language is kind of what his problem is. Shredded duck confit. The union ballroom looked immaculate. 40 round tables, all dolled up in ivory linen with a vase of white roses in the center, rested comfortably on the glazed hardwood floor. 10 chairs, also draped in ivory linen, encircled each table, making the large, gothic room feel warm and intimate, and as pure-looking as a hospital nursery filled with sleeping newborn babies. Each place setting featured a gold charger around which were painstakingly placed, from left to right, one B&B plate with a warm roll, butter, and a butter knife, one salad fork, one dinner fork, one dessert fork placed above the charger, one dinner knife, one coffee spoon, one champagne flute, one wine glass, one pre-filled ice water goblet, and one coffee cup and saucer. The silver and gold of each place setting, catching the day's last glimmering light, gave the room a sparkle usually reserved for royal eyes only, and, of course, for the caterers who serve them. I was busy stacking water goblets for the water station so that the undoubtedly drunk socialites could stay hydrated throughout the night when my supervisor, Miss Jones, found me. I'd just begun my fourth tier, an impressive height for water goblets, and was visualizing the splendor of a fifth. I was a slave in ancient Egypt, yes, but this was my great pyramid. What's happening here, Alfred? Miss Jones began in her typical passive-aggressive manner. I reached into the rack on my right and pulled out another goblet to stack. The key is taking the time to build a solid foundation, smooth corners and straight lines. When you've got your solid foundation, the stacking is easy. You know, we're quite busy in Pendleton right now with the Western Women United's cocktail hour, Miss Jones continued, and we're just so short-staffed tonight, as I'm sure you know. I reached into the rack and pulled out another goblet to stack. Focused on my creation, I was determined to see it completed. I wasn't just haphazardly putting it together for the drunks, who with one uncoordinated lurch could bring the whole thing crashing down, but rather, I was building this glass pyramid for my fellow caterers and me to appreciate. Joe had to leave early, Miss Jones explained, you know, for his, rehearsal. So now we don't have enough hand passers in Pendleton. There was a pause. Then, with all the emphasis of a plea, she added, unless... I turned to face her. She was tall and thin, and with such a plain expression on her face, she looked like nothing more than a breadstick in a bow tie. I smiled, but didn't say a thing. I just looked into her poppy seed eyes and waited. You've hand-passed before, right? Nope, never. Miss Jones received my answer plainly, yet now it was she who was looking into my eyes and waiting. I didn't want to leave my creation unfinished, especially considering how much I'd already done and how little I had left to do, but, technically, the arrangement of water goblets at the water station is considered a non-essential task, so long as there were enough goblets out there, which there already were, and since I was a slave to my job, I had no choice but to oblige the wishes of my superior. Let us go then, you and I finally proposed, and with quick steps and awkward glances, we headed toward Pendletron and away from the Immaculate Ballroom. On our way, Miss Jones told me that, essentially, it is the hand-passer's job to walk into a room full of drunk or otherwise anxious men and women, in this case only women, with a tray full of food and let them all know, without shouting, that he's the keeper of the free appetizers. Under no circumstance, she added, should the guests feel required to contain themselves, except that they please take a cocktail napkin and use the tongs to remove the morsel from the tray. So on and round the room the caterer goes, hand-passing his appetizers until his tray and or the room is empty. When we arrived at the Pendletron servery, Miss Jones pointed out the hotbox where the appetizers were being kept and told me to figure out with the other caterers which appetizer to hand pass. She then abruptly left the room. Immediately, I stood up tall and pulled my arms in as tight as I could, doing for my fellow caterers my best breadstick impression. Then they did theirs, and we all laughed. "What do we got today?" I asked as I pulled open the hot box door, enveloping myself in warmth. "Dunno," Serena replied quickly, still a little laugh-happy. "Jasmine took the contract and ran off, probably to go chill on the fourth floor or something." "Mm-hmm," John groaned, as I was trying to go chill, but that girl beat me to it. Now I gotta hand pass, or Miss Jones will be serving me. "Shit. Well, I guess we can just go with the old taste-and-guess approach to figuring out what these little things are," I said, as I reached for one of the appetizers, seeing as how Miss Jones is gone. "Done and done," John replied. "That top one there's that ginger chicken cake everybody loves, with the garlic aioli dip. And that bottom one's just a tomato basil and mozzarella bruschetta. But the one you're holding? Shit, I've never had anything like that before." "It's cold," I said. "How long have these been in the hot box?" "I just put them in there a few minutes ago when I got up here," Serena admitted. "They were on top of the hot box, so I just figured someone left them out." "I don't know if you should have done that," I said. "They're probably meant to be served cold." "All right, Chef J. Alfred Prufrock," John quipped. "You can serve that one since you know all about it." I smiled, took a close look at the morsel in my hand, and then, like an ape, shoved it whole into my mouth.
I think the biggest mistake anyone can make in reading or listening to the story is not having eaten before. I think there's like three or four times when you just describe these appetizers with like amazing intricacy. How did you get so good at describing food? Is that part of the job? Because you know you work as a caterer, right?
Yeah. So yeah, as a caterer, we get to try, I guess, the foods. You know, no, we're not allowed to try the food, but we do, because what else are we gonna do?
Of course, don't do your job. You know?
But yeah, we get exposed to a lot of foods that we, you know, the normal college student isn't exposed to.
Yeah.
As I moved a little deeper into the room, I was struck by an obtrusive odor that thickened the air, so much so that I felt like I might drown if I went too deep. It was the mermaid's perfume, of course, and from my perspective, I couldn't decide if I wanted to throw up or be drowned in it with them. I walked around the room, expecting these women, particularly those who were hungry, to make eye contact with me or to use some gesture or other to signal to me that they wanted me to bring my tray of delicious appetizers over to them, but such was not the case. They appeared consumed by themselves and the tedium of the evening's events. Still, I approached a pair of women who were floating nearest to me and asked if they'd like an appetizer. "Good evening, ladies," I began. "Would you like to try an appetizer? This in here is a fried wonton wrapper with shredded duck and roasted red peppers on top." The women didn't say anything, so I continued on. "It's also got a nice citrus zest that gives it a real explosion of..." I noticed the women on the right wince. And with that, I gave up. Their loss. Apparently, a nice citrus zest is just too extreme for some people. Whatever. Unfazed, I moved to my right towards the next group of women who were passionately chatting about something or other. I raised my tray, pushing it closer to the women in an attempt to steal their attention, but they just kept on chatting. "Did you see what Mary Kate did with her hair? Oh my God, I know, it looks ridiculous." I pushed my tray even further into the faces of these chatting women, but they just turned their heads and railed on. "If you ask me, I think her hair is sculpted quite beautifully now." "Shut up, Michelangelo! Nobody asked you!" I lowered my tray and moved invisibly on to the next group of women, and then to the next, and to the next, and to the next. But none of these women, it seemed, had any interest in trying one of my delicious appetizers, which surprised me because, if nothing else, I was offering them free food and they were refusing. I mean, there are plenty of people I know who'd absolutely lose their shit if someone put a tray of free food in their face. No questions asked. That tray'd be empty in 30 seconds or fewer.
Yeah, well, I guess the idea came from an experience I've had trying to hand pass and being relatively unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And just the longer you go on, the heavier the tray gets. And yeah. It's just like a simple task, but it gets...
Was there a lady that was like...
"That sounds too Asian."
Like, no, I don't know where that came from.
Okay, okay.
I make the people sound much worse than that.
"They're going bonkers for these ginger chicken cakes again," Serena said as she pulled another batch from the hot box. "And they're killing this bruschetta too," John added on his way back into the room for round two. "The fuck?" I blurted, surprised. Ginger chicken cakes and tomato, basil, and mozzarella bruschetta are tasty items, no doubt, and for sure very popular. But not one of the women in that room even considered trying one of my citrus-zested fried wonton wrappers with shredded duck and roasted red peppers. They're crunchy and chewy, sweet and salty, and they're fucking delicious. Clearly all the women are hungry, so what the fuck? Not one of those clowns never even tried one of these guys, I explained. What's happening here, Alfred? Miss Jones unexpectedly inquired. Sorry, Miss Jones, I said, turning around, but no one has tried one of my appetizers yet. As I'm sure you know, Alfred, we try to refer to what we hand pass as hors d'oeuvres, not appetizers. I smiled but didn't say a thing. I just looked into her poppy seed eyes and waited. Well, certainly something's happening here, but I don't know what it is, she observed, her facial expression as plain as ever. Then she abruptly turned and walked out of the servery. Follow me, Serena said. Maybe I can help. Together, trays held high, we walked back into the room via the service door. In the room, the women come and go.
But yeah, talk a little bit about J. Alfred Prufrock and what it means to this story.
Yeah, so I read that poem first time in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so freaking good.
Yeah.
But I've come back to it a bunch of times over the years.
Yeah, that poem doesn't rhyme, you know.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was trying to create this feeling, this mm-hmm. sense of that you get in the poem, that the poem is at once extremely funny and excruciatingly painful.
Yeah.
And I think the way it plays on that kind of seesaw, that balance, I think it's interesting. Don't forget to try the garlic aioli dip, Serena added, to which the group gave ringing reviews. It was beautiful. Serena had baited them, and now the hook was firmly in their mouths. I figured all I had to do was reel them in. Can I interest anyone in another tasty morsel? I asked. This in here is a shredded duck wonton wrapper with roasted red peppers and a citrus zest, served chilled. Oh my, one of the women responded. That sounds too Asian, chimed in another nasally. But the duck is so tender. It has been slow-cooked in its own fat for hours and seasoned with only the freshest herbs and spices. Plus, what about those roasted red peppers? So soft and so sweet, so juicy. They're a delicacy, goddammit. What's your problem? I mean, do you even know what citrus zest is? It's literally the orange of an orange. Yeah, that's fucking right. It's that colored skin you've always neglected, somehow unable to realize on your own that it's actually full of flavor. Couple that with the freshly ground Himalayan pink salt crystals on that fried wonton wrapper, and you'll never have to deal with soy sauce again, you racist clown. I walked away in disgust, leaving Serena alone to feed the frenzy. I retreated again to the servery via the service door. Miss Jones was waiting for me when I got there, standing perfectly still with that plain-looking face and those stale eyes. A fucking breadstick in a fucking bow tie. How's it, going out there? She inquired. I pushed my tray toward her face with a grunt and asked if she wanted one. Tasty appetizer? I think you mean hors d'oeuvre, right, Alfred? And I'm sure you know we're not supposed to eat what we serve. Before I could respond, she turned around and quickly left the servery. I glanced over at my fully loaded tray that was now resting comfortably on one of the servery's brown fold-up tables. Was it possible that this appetizer was not as good as I thought? I picked one up by the fried wonton wrapper and tossed it into my mouth. It crunched as it had before, it chewed as it had before, and it exploded with flavor, another orgasm in my mouth as it had before. This baby was the real deal, and I knew it. So what was wrong with me that I couldn't give it away for free? With smiles and empty silver trays shining, Serena and John came into the servery. We're off to the fourth floor now, Alfred, John hissed. Good luck hand-passing your little ducky. I put my head down and studied the cracked, fading tile floor of the servery beneath my black shoes. This was where I belonged. Not out there with all those fish in the sea, but here, alone in a back room somewhere, with the floor cracking and deteriorating beneath my feet. Hand-passing get the best of you, Alfie? A woman's voice playfully inquired, abruptly ending my silent wallowing. I looked up to see, to my surprise, Jasmine, who must have figured the hand-passing was finished, leaning against the servery door with her outside elbow cocked and her hand holding her exposed hip. Serena and John seemed to be successful, I replied, unable to avert my gaze. With those women out there, I don't think they'll sing to me. Jasmine smiled and looked into my eyes.
Her hair was long like seaweed, red and brown. She reached into her back pocket and pulled out a collection of folded up papers, the event's contract. "Which appetizer were you trying to hand pass?" she asked, before dropping the papers on the floor. "The fried wonton wrapper with shredded duck, roasted red peppers, and a citrus zest," I hastily replied. Jasmine turned and, keeping her legs straight, bent over to pick up the contract. She held the position long enough to peruse the papers as they lay on the floor. Then she turned her head to face me. "You mean the shredded duck confit?" What's happening here, Alfred?" Miss Jones interjected from the doorway. I got up off the floor and tucked my shirt back into my pants. I glanced at Jasmine, who was doing the same. Together, we looked at our supervisor and laughed. "I know something is happening here," Miss Jones said, "but I don't know what it is." "Well, I do," I declared, zipping up my tie. "This tasty morsel here is called shredded duck confit, just as what I'm hand-passing are called hors d'oeuvres and not fucking appetizers." I tightened my belt one notch, grabbed my still fully loaded tray, and strode out of the servery into Pendletron, feeling as if I had just punched a hole through the wall. I could finally speak the language, and it was such a funny feeling. In the room, the women come and go. The sea was still full, and, without thinking, I swam right up to the woman floating closest to me and asked, "Would you like to try an hors d'oeuvre, ma'am? I think you'll like my shredded duck confit." Now, all the evening's events are over, and all that's left to do is clean up. I return to the ballroom that I'd spent most of my day setting up as immaculately as possible. But it no longer looks as immaculate as it had in that glimmering light. Caterers are everywhere. Racks of creamed parfait glasses, lipstick-smeared champagne flutes, and foamed pilsners, stacked 10 high, are being dragged away like wounded soldiers in a combat zone. All the silverware, now greasy and used, is being put into sorters, which will be loaded onto carts bound for the dish tank. The pure white linens that once dressed the round tables are stained, if not stripped off and lying in a heap on the hardwood floor. Whether naked, ruined, or both, these tables have all been deflowered, and not even a vase remains to remind me of what was once so beautifully alive there. I turn, stiffly, to the water station where only the ruins of my great pyramid remain. One by one, I take a goblet from the table and put it back into the rack on my right, where it belongs.
Jeff, it's been a pleasure having you on as our first short story writer on the show.
Pleasure was all mine.
Oh, please, you. Yeah, guys, I never had one of these before. I don't know what to say.
You don't have a closing?
Well, there's like another segment like coming after this. Off. Everyone, hang on. We got Brendan McCaffrey coming on after this. We're going to be doing some poetry. It's going to be great. I guess that's the sign.
Hello and welcome to Words, the podcast where we talk about words and with the people who wrote them. I'm Phil Whitavy.
I'm Jack Bologna.
And today we are joined by
Brendan McCaffrey,
who is going to be reading some of his poetry for us today.
Yeah. All right, this first one is...
Well, do you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I'm a 6-year senior at the University of Michigan. I'm about a golf cart and an Indian away from being Van Wilder.
Wow, that's kind of that's high praise for yourself there.
Yeah, I'm an egomaniac.
At least he's honest.
Yeah. And so basically, a lot of my stuff has to deal with drugs, alcohol, sex.
Yeah, but Van
Wilder, much a college experience.
But Van Wilder had like a very positive experience with that. But your poetry isn't always about the positive side of that.
No, it is not. No.
Are you the dark side of Van Wilder, maybe? Would that be fair to say?
The drug side? Yes.
Oh, the dark side.
The dark side? Yeah. Oh. I could be... Oh, God, I feel so nerdy saying this. I'm the Sith Lord of Van Wilder. Originally it did start off as a positive experience, but eventually it just kind of spiraled into something that was not positive, yeah. Which I think anyone that uses a lot, it's bound to happen.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that on the way back up, though.
Right. I'm at 42 days. Okay. So this first one's called 13 Manly Methods to Modernity, or We All Wish We Were Bukowski. One, is this life just another dream, like the ones in bed, just physical, fanciful, restless manifestations? Two, live, laugh, love, Rosalie encapsulates the bestial truth of our vulgar fundamental stasis, eating, shitting, and fucking. Three, since true self-improvement is masturbation, I never know when I might bust one off. But I have taken a look at society, I've sold all of my shares in Kleenex. Four, relationships between a man and a woman are nothing more than a game of words, gestures, and changing degrees of plotted sincerity. Five, love is understanding with the suspension of judgment, to sense the other thoughtlessly and profoundly, our bodies only portals into the surrounding reality.
Get a lot of like really profound things about love, and so there seems to be a kind of conflict in this poem because I could say like the writer of this poem, and maybe like you're in a different place now, so I'm just kind of speaking to like what's on this page, but there's this great line where it's like, love is understanding with the suspension of judgment, to sense the others thoughtlessly and profoundly, our bodies only portals into the surrounding reality. This is an ethical prescription that's like grounded in a huge cosmological argument, you know. And there's a lot of, I think
I was reading some shit back then.
yeah so I guess I just think that's kind of an interesting tension, and I use the word tension a lot on this podcast.
Six, I've only encountered true art in other people, like how that gambling gypsy holds a cigarette between his pinky and ring finger, between hands of Hold'em. Seven, yesterday and tomorrow fade into their unreality when I recognize this. Eight, rather than wasting time worrying, just assume every girl wants to with you. I'm sure they do. Nine, opposites come together. Where there is love is hate soon enough. Magnetic and electric, our differences melt like any two-faced coin in a foundry. 10. Books are just an easy way to learn what you'll know by experience, but most people are illiterate in both ways.
I feel like that's you kind of coming to term with, you read a lot of books, but you kind of have like this kind of question, like, what's worth more? Is it, you know, living, or is it about writing about living or reading about living? Like, at what point do you kind of leap from the page and just...
I think it is about both. Yeah, it is kind of like, I think the way I write is how I deal with my experiences in life.
Yeah.
And as far as like when I was referencing people are illiterate in both, I think a lot of people...
Is it just like being awkward and not trying new things?
Not trying new things, mm-hmm. or like not reading the vibes, or like they're not following their intuition. I feel like a lot of people have these self-limiting beliefs about what they can and cannot do.
Yeah.
11. There's more to discover in silence and space than words and things, like the sultry vacuum between our lips and the cold, unsatisfied afterglow.
It feels like
I think it, like each one of these when I'm in a different mode, it's almost like a mantra to myself. Huh.
That would definitely kind of tie in with what you were saying about spirituality, and I thought that this stanza was really spiritual, this whole like idea of silence and space, that seems like a meditation to me, so that...
It was, yeah.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
Right. 12. I don't know which I prefer, coming or just after, noisy flatulence or the silent farts I blame on poor fat souls. 13. As an egoist and part-time plagiarist, at least I'll pretend to play the role better than everyone else. 14. Will the eunuch prophets please euthanize themselves? We can all comprehend that all is one grand mindfuck. It's called Parties at the Ivory Tower. I don't know much about space-time and Einstein, nor ancient history. And necessarily, languages have too many rules and exceptions to learn like everything in life. And these confessions of ignorance are meaningless. Our every act belies some stupidity, wrinkling and unraveling reality. Ego, identity, and memories, like hazy weekend nights, arm wrestle the future and grapple with the past. Right, and I think that's like your identity is in flux. That's kind of what I was trying to express there.
Yeah, and especially like when you're at a party or a bar and you're not totally sober. And your identity is like really like it's at this it's moment, changing. This tenuous moment, yeah, where it's, yeah.
It could be some people are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I still can't recall those girls' names from Saturday night, or the number of beers, joints, cigarettes, lines of blow, Xanax bars, and Adderalls I consumed, or even if I ended up using a Jimmy hat. Yet I retain a rough estimate of what I have done and failed to do, and I've come to understand human camaraderie drowned in mutual debauchery.
And I feel like especially at college, there's so many people that like are, you know, become friends from like partying or like going out together. And sometimes like you hang out and everyone is like totally sober or whatever.
And it's weird.
Yeah, and like you have like nothing to talk about. And,
you're their drinking buddy. So yeah, I took some time off of school and I realized that and I go, man, I had fucking 300 people on my phone, and I don't have anyone to call because I'm trying to, like, stay sober. They're just drinking buddies. They were just drinking buddies in the end. So by incorporating these encounters, experienced and borrowed, I may only know now, but not yesterday and tomorrow.
I mean, yeah.
Like I never thought I'd be doing these things, and it kind of does give you a glimpse. This is stuff I was really doing at the time.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, people. Like when you get down to brass tacks, all these things are just social crutches to interact.
Yeah.
And I think if you can raise, I don't want to sound like fucking some hippy dippy douchebag, but I'm thinking you can raise your consciousness level or your energy level at least. You can have fun with those people too at the same time while they're drunk, and it's even funner because they're dumb
and you don't have a hangover in the morning,
right? And you wake up like, I woke up at 6:30 this morning. Like, that would have never happened unless I had a painful hangover.
You are the poet on the very first episode of Words, the podcast, and you have some pretty sexual and some pretty vulgar poetry, and I think a lot of listeners out there might be thinking, like, Jack, like, why did you, you know, feature such sexual and vulgar poetry for the very first episode of Words? Why, so I want to ask you, and because sometimes I seem to be asking myself that too. But why is it important to write about, I guess, the things that are true in life? You write about things that have happened in your life that sometimes are really uncomfortable to talk about for some people.
I mean, I kind of think it's the elephant in the room. Yeah. And especially when it comes to sex.
Yeah.
Like,
My dad is totally... you know, stop listening to the podcast at this point. No, he said.
Yeah. Oh, is he listening to it?
Well, not anymore. No, no, but please keep going.
My dad's probably just shaking his head, going, "God damn it, Brendan." I just think, even as much as like our society today is sexualized and stuff like that, this is one thing I have a huge problem with, and
we don't talk openly and honestly about it.
So, like, sex. Yeah. Our generation, we go through Tinder, like... it seems very lame to me. And for me, like, I love that when you approach a girl that you find is beautiful or whatever, and that before you hear that response, that little, like, goosebumps or that awkwardness, like, the... Yeah. And it's just interstices.
You're feeling things.
Yeah, the great. You're actually feeling right, yeah. And behind a keyboard, you can plan out your responses.
Hey guys, thanks again for tuning in to the very first episode of Words, the podcast. Please remember to tune in each week. Before we get to the outtakes of today's episode, it's time for the credits. Phil Widevine, Yassine the Beans Abdulmuki, and Jack Bologna are the show's co-hosts. Jack Bologna is the show's creator, Diane Thatch is our artist, and you are the listener. Thanks so much, guys.
Did you do the introduction with Jeff?
Yeah. Okay. I was just like, "Yo, what's up, Jeff?" And Jeff was like, "Hey," and then we. It was better than that. It was I'm you know.
So my line is, "Hey."
Maybe I don't know.
After yo, what's up?
Okay. Yo, what's up?
All right. I can deliver.
We're just kind of worried about our wide reach, you know, like. We're pretty.
Tim Tebow is our demographic for this podcast, really. You know,
Christian evangelicals
that play football and have won Heisman's.
Yeah,
It's a very narrow range.
Very
That's
narrow.
What our consultant said would be a good idea.
I know. We gotta fire that guy.
How do you pronounce the word vase? Vase.
Vase.
That's like the New Jersey.
Vase. Is it vase vase?
Well, see, you know, my mom always explained that. A vase is a vase you can't afford to replace.
This is a bit off topic, but personally, what do you think was like a bigger coup for you, getting interviewed by these 10 and 11 year old girls, or Words the podcast, you know?
That's true.
Please don't answer that question.
But I would never do an interview on a slide.
That's just ridiculous.
That's against the whole spirit of the enterprise.
Chris Matthews, he wrote this book called My Life as a Political Campaign. Uh-huh. Now, that to me is, why the fuck would you want your life to be a political campaign where you are just pandering, you are phony as fuck.
Yeah.
I think you should just...
Yeah. So I waited a year and... That's the furnace kicking in, isn't it?
No, that's the water heater. I can't see. There's a switch I can turn the heater off, which I've done, but
that's okay. It'll add color, right?
Definitely.